From Montpelier, Vermont, this is Public Health Radio. On today's show, Fred Rivara joins us to discuss the problem of injuries as seen from a public health perspective. We'll look at the major injury problems and the effectiveness of different strategies used to prevent these injuries. And we'll also talk about why the field of injury analysis and prevention has generated so much more political controversy than the analysis of illness and diseases. Then, later in the show, I'll address a question our listeners often ask us. How do we decide what topics to address on Public Health Radio? But first, some news from the world of public health. This is Public Health Radio. I'm your host, Marvin Malik. According to a study released in this month's issue of Health Affairs, 30% of adults with private health insurance coverage have policies that do not include vaccinations. Even more remarkable was the finding in the study that among children with private health insurance, 15% don't cover routine immunization. The finding for children was somewhat surprising, since over half the states require coverage of standard childhood vaccines, while not a single state mandates private insurers to provide coverage for adult vaccination. A June 6th article in the Los Angeles Times documented the increasing prevalence of what are called limited benefit health plans. Many of the plans cover physician visits and some prescription drugs, but not hospital care, catastrophic care, or mental health treatment. These plans all have coverage caps, limiting the amount the plan will pay out in any given year. These caps range from a high of $20,000 to as little as $1,000 in annual spending. More than 20 national employers plan to begin offering such plans later this year, including such companies as Intel, IBM, and Sears. Observers of the deteriorating state of health insurance in the U.S. indicate that these plans may further skew the notion of just what it means to have health insurance, since insurance through these plans would offer very little protection from financial ruin if a significant illness were to develop. Listeners wishing to learn more about the issue are referred to the February airing of Public Health Radio, which addressed the issue of medical bankruptcy. If such limited benefit health plans continue to grow, bankruptcies related to the cost of medical care, already accounting for nearly half the bankruptcies in the U.S., will likely grow even further. The February edition of Public Health Radio is available at our website, publichealthradio.org. An article by Sharon Lafreniere in the June 3rd edition of the New York Times examined how the HIV pandemic has contributed to earlier sexual activity and less education for many African girls, especially AIDS orphans. Poverty, pregnancy at a young age, and a lack of education have been problems for young women in Africa for a long time, but over the past 25 years, trends had begun improving as more African girls have received formal schooling and married later in life. However, the HIV pandemic threatens to take away those hard-won gains, especially among female AIDS orphans who are being propelled into sex at shockingly early ages to support themselves, their siblings, and often their own children. About 12 million children in sub-Saharan Africa have lost one or both parents due to AIDS-related causes, and orphan girls are at an increased risk of sexual exploitation because of their low status in society. A recent UNICEF study of orphaned girls in Zimbabwe found that such girls are 3 times as likely as girls whose parents are alive to contract HIV. In Zambia, orphan girls often are the first to be taken out of schools, and also that there are a growing number of adolescent girls who are forced to work as maids or prostitutes in the southern African country of Lesotho. The House of Representatives Appropriation Committee approved an amendment to a major spending bill, which would no longer allow trade agreements to ban prescription drug reimportation. Recent trade agreements the Bush administration signed with Australia, Singapore, and Morocco have included provisions banning reimportation at the request of pharmaceutical companies. Ann Northrup, a Republican representative from Kentucky, introduced the amendment to the appropriations bill. She was quoted by the Wall Street Journal as characterizing this type of provision in trade agreements as a backdoor effort by the Bush administration to use trade agreements to prevent drug reimportation. The Republican Party is split on the issue, with those in leadership positions in the Congress supporting the Bush administration's efforts to block drug reimportation, while many rank-and-file Republicans in Congress and most Democratic legislators supporting provisions that would facilitate the reimportation of prescription drugs from other countries. Drug prices in the United States are approximately 40 to 60% higher than costs in most other developed countries. On a related issue, a report from Express Scripts, one of the largest pharmacy benefit management companies, reported that prescription drug costs increased by 10% last year. About 70% of that increase was due to higher pricing of prescription drugs by the industry, while most of the remainder was brought about from increased use of drugs. Coming up next, a public health approach to the study and prevention of injuries. So stay tuned. This is Public Health Radio. I'm your host, Marvin Malik. Injuries are the leading cause of death and disability for children and young adults ranging from ages 1 through 44 years of age. Despite this, public health techniques have been applied to the analysis and prevention of injuries for just a few decades. The field is broad and complex due to the wide variety of types of injuries that can occur. Just to give a few examples, injury researchers may evaluate burns and crush injuries occurring at the workplace, hip fractures suffered at home by an elderly woman, or a child with a major brain injury occurring when the child was struck by an automobile as she darts into the street chasing a ball that bounced into the roadway. For many years, such events were called accidents. Applying the term accident to injuries reinforced the view that injuries were random events that could not be analyzed or prevented. Over the last few decades, however, a cadre of public health researchers and activists have turned their attention to the problem of injuries and have achieved some notable successes, reducing the number and severity of injuries in the transportation system, in the workplace, in playgrounds, and reducing the number of head injuries suffered by children. Our guest today to discuss the field of injury is Fred Rivara, an expert in the field of injury prevention. Dr. Rivara was the director of the Harborview Injury Prevention and Research Center at the University of Washington in Seattle from 1987 through the year 2000, and has published dozens of articles and books on the problem of injuries, with a special focus on injuries to children. For the last 10 years, Dr. Rivara has also served as the director of the Division of General Pediatrics at the University of Washington School of Medicine. Fred Rivara, welcome to Public Health Radio.
Thanks very much for having me.
Most people are familiar with techniques of public health and epidemiology when they're used in exploring diseases and epidemics of disease. And, for example, a lot of publicity occurred centering around the exploration of HIV and SARS recently. And in some cases, like in HIV, it can take several years to carefully explore affected populations and contexts to learn how disease is transmitted and how to prevent it. But when people think about a neighbor in a traffic accident or their grandmother falling and breaking a hip, I think most people would view it quite odd to think about how to use those same public health techniques to study or attempt to prevent those kinds of events. So I want to get your point of view on that.
Well, I think that, in fact, the main techniques of epidemiology that have been used to study breast cancer or lung cancer or heart disease are also very applicable to injury problems. I think one place to start is the fact that we call these events injuries. We don't call them accidents, and for very good reasons. Accidents implies something that happens at random. It implies something that's sort of a act of God, or it's your fate to have happen to you, and something that can't be predicted nor can it be controlled. But that really is not true. We refer to these events as injuries, talking about the damage to the person's body, the different parts of their body, and as events that really are in many ways predictable, and I think we have to approach them as completely preventable. Right now, in our state of knowledge and our state of technological expertise, they may not be all preventable, but I think ultimately we should look at them that way and try to think of different ways we can prevent these injuries from happening. So if you take it as something that is predictable, but then you can begin to use those same techniques of epidemiology to look at what are the factors that increase the risk of these injuries happen, or what are the factors that would protect you from having an injury. And we know that there are, over time, a lot of factors that have come out pretty clearly as risk factors for injury. One is being a male. We know that males have about twice the rate of injuries than do females. And why might that be so? I don't think there's anything inherent in the organism of being male or female that leads you to be an injury. But males, we know, tend to engage in riskier behavior than do females. They do riskier activities than do females. And even when they do the same activities like driving a car, they tend to do it in a more risky fashion, like they drive faster or they drive when drunk. So gender is certainly an important risk factor. We also know that age is an important risk factor. If you look at a group of people in a population, we know that injuries actually tend to peak among teenagers and young adults, and then decrease in middle age, and then increase again for the elderly, mostly because of falls related to hip fractures. And at each age, there are predictable kinds of injuries. We know that school-age children are more likely to be injured from riding their bicycle or crossing streets or drowning. And we know that young adults are likely to be involved with injuries because they've been drinking, whether it be drinking while driving or drinking while swimming or drinking while smoking a cigarette at home at night or drinking in other kinds of recreational activities. And we know that the elderly are most likely to be involved with falls. They pose a tremendous hazard combined with osteoporosis leads to falls and fractures in the elderly. So those are just two of the risk factors that epidemiology can tell us a lot about that increase the risk of injury.
A factor that I know influences public health practitioners and motivating them to look at a health problem more carefully relates to the magnitude of that problem. And you just mentioned a variety of risk factors for injury. But overall, when you look at injury compared to, say, other major causes of death or hospitalization, how important a problem are injuries compared to cancer or heart disease or other major disease problems?
Well, I think that people don't realize how important injuries are. There's well over 100,000 people a year who die from injuries. And for people between 1 year of age and age 35, injuries are by far and away the most common cause of death, bar none. And then after that, they're still ranked in the top 10 most common causes of death. in terms of medical care costs, it's estimated that over a cost to our society, medical care, lost productivity, lost wages, accounts for over $200 billion a year, $200 billion a year related to injuries. And we're all very, very conscious of the amount of our the healthcare dollar, how much of the GNP that it accounts for right now. And in fact, injuries account for about 12% of the healthcare dollar. So injuries, in any way you look at it, are a major problem in our society, as they are in all societies. And because of that, they really deserve our attention.
You are a pediatrician. And as a pediatrician, is your training in pediatrics something that led you to become interested in injuries? And I was wondering if you could talk about whether you think the issue of injury has special significance to children.
Pediatricians tend to think about prevention overall. We spend a lot of our time doing well-child checkups on children, not because they're sick, but because we're trying to prevent them from becoming sick. We give immunizations not to treat polio, not to treat diphtheria, not to treat measles, but to prevent those illnesses from happening. So thinking about prevention is really an important part of a pediatrician's job. And then when you look at the data, as you just said, that the most important cause of death and serious disability, acquired disability in childhood and adolescence, is injuries, it makes sense that a pediatrician would be concerned about prevention of injuries. And in fact, that's one of the reasons I became involved. The other reason is that for the last 20 years, I worked at a level one trauma center, a regional trauma center, where every day we see people come into the hospital. This morning, I was in the emergency room involved with the care of a young infant under 1 month of age who, unfortunately, was being held in the lap of somebody while riding in the car, was not in a car seat, and they were in a car wreck, and the child has a significant head injury as a result. That injury is completely preventable. And those are the kinds of things that me as a pediatrician seeing those motivates me to become involved with trying to prevent these injuries on an individual level and on a community level.
I wanted to just talk a bit about the types of injuries that the field of injury control addresses itself to, and maybe head trauma would be a particularly important one, maybe especially for children. I was wondering if you could highlight that.
There are two kinds of injuries which I think are particularly disturbing, and those are head injuries and burns. And they're disturbing because they're common and because they don't heal completely. Of those who die from trauma, it's the most common cause of death from trauma. About 85% of children who die from injuries are going to die because of head injuries. And frankly, we're, as physicians, not very good at treating it. We do a lot of intensive care, a lot of procedures on these children, but ultimately we can't reverse the damage done to the brain. The body will heal some of it, oftentimes will not heal it completely. Children coming to the hospital with coma, about a third of those children will die if it's from trauma. And of those who don't die, most of those children are going to be left with some significant disability. Not all, but certainly most of them will. This represents tremendous cost to their families, to schools, to society, emotional costs, financial costs, rehabilitation costs. So head injuries are a tremendously important problem, very common, with limited capabilities of us as physicians to really reverse what's happened. And it really brings up the point that the only way to prevent that occurring is really to try to prevent the head injury in the first place. We can't fix it when it happens. We need to try to prevent them. And in fact, there are ways of doing that. The other kinds of injuries that leave lifelong disability potentially are burns. Mortality is much lower in burns than it is for head injuries, but third-degree burn is going to scar. Even if it's grafted, it's still going to be a scar. And they can represent tremendous disability, disfiguring disability in the case of facial burns. So those are two injuries that are pretty common, serious, but end up with lifelong disability. Most fractures, most abdominal injuries, most of those children are going to do pretty well. They're certainly going to have some short-term disability, but long-term disability is going to be much less than in the case of head injuries and in some cases burns.
One of the major causes of injury mortality in the U.S. and I assume in other countries has to do with transportation. And I was wondering if you could talk a bit about transportation injuries, what ways people get injured when they're involved in the transportation system, and what you think the greatest avenues for reducing those injuries might be.
Well, overall, in the United States, there's about 40,000 people who die each year from motor vehicle crashes. And most of those are people riding inside of cars, occupants of cars. There are some that are motorcyclists, and about 10% that are pedestrian. These are certainly concerning, and although we have these 40,000 deaths, there are probably 10 to 20 times the number of people who are seriously injured in crashes who don't die. So the potential there for serious disability is really quite high. It's very clear that there are many things we can do to try to prevent those injuries. As a society, we build safe roads. Our highways and our expressways, throughways are much safer than our sort of the old-fashioned country roads or the Route 66. But more than that, we've also have had legislation and regulations requiring cars to be safe. And the cars now are much safer than they were 20 years ago and 30 years ago. The idea is trying to package the individual in the car in such a way that there's not, in a crash, the insides of the car don't intrude on the passenger, that the passenger doesn't hit unprotected, unpadded parts of the car, and that the crash that happens can be separated from the injuries. In other words, you can have a crash without necessarily having an injury. That's our goal. We may not be able to prevent all crashes, but we should be able to try to prevent those injuries from happening. And it's the single most important way to prevent yourself from being injured while in a car is wearing a seatbelt, or in case of a child, being properly restrained in an age-appropriate device. Seatbelts are very effective. They decrease the risk of serious injury and death by 60 to 70%. And we know that legislation, when it's passed, combined with enforcement and education, can result in high rates of seatbelt use. Here in the state of Washington, we have 95% of people are buckled up. It's an educated population combined with a seatbelt law that's enforced by the police. Those things really can make a difference. Other kinds of transport injuries are motorcycles, and it's really a concern. I was speaking last week to the head of traffic safety here in the state, and he told me that the number of registered motorcycles in the state has doubled in the last 5 years, and that has been followed by a consequent increase in the number of crashes and injuries from motorcycling. And I think there's a number of important things to realize about motorcycle injuries. You're on the order of about tenfold more likely to be seriously injured if you're in a motorcycle crash than if you're inside a car. So we have to realize that motorcycling is inherently risky. Secondly, is many people are buying very powerful motorcycles, motorcycles that can go very, very fast, and they handle quite differently than a smaller motorcycle that they might have used in the past and gotten experience on or received training on. And the third thing is obviously helmets. The most common cause of death from motorcycle crash are helmets, and helmets are effective. They're not 100% effective because the speeds can be very, very high, but they do decrease the risk of serious and fatal head injury. They should be worn at all times. Unfortunately, not every state in the country has a motorcycle helmet law, but even if your state doesn't, everyone would agree that wearing a helmet is a way to protect yourself. And then the final way of involvement with transport injuries are pedestrian injuries, and it's a very difficult problem. I worked on it for a lot of years, and I think that people have generally come to conclude that we should do training programs to teach kids to cross the street safely, but that's clearly not enough. What we need to do is in residential areas where kids are out playing is to slow down traffic. Traffic circles, barriers or speed bumps to slow down traffic have been shown, particularly in Europe, to be quite effective in decreasing the risk of pedestrian injuries. So we should really think, and it also makes your city more livable. We should think about implementing those on a much wider basis in our neighborhoods and cities.
As I was researching the topic before this interview, I noticed that the rates of transportation injuries in Northern Europe are a good deal lower than in the United States. Do you see transforming our transportation system as a potential strategy to prevent injuries? Is our current system itself dangerous?
I think that in terms of pedestrian injuries, that we tend to make the car king in our communities. We don't allow for children, pedestrians, to easily cross streets and major thoroughfares. If you go to Northern Europe, places like Sweden, they've really thought through this very carefully, and they have ring roads around towns, and most of the traffic in a town is diverted to those kinds of ring roads. And within the city itself, they tend to have much less traffic, and in fact, there are pedestrian areas which are car-free. We really have that very rarely in any of our big cities in the United States do we have car-free areas just for pedestrians. Those kinds of ways of downplaying the importance of motor vehicles and increasing the importance of pedestrians and livability can play an important part in our society.
Now, the second major type of injuries is injuries related to recreation. And I know that there's been a good deal of study of, in particular, children using motorized forms of transportation, such as snowmobiles and all-terrain vehicles.
Right.
And I was wondering if you could talk a bit about, especially a pediatrician's point of view of appropriate recreation for children.
This is a major problem, and I think it's a major problem, particularly in rural areas. I was talking with one of my colleagues in Arkansas not long ago, and she told me that motorized all-terrain vehicles, ATVs, are now outnumbering motor vehicles as the cause of injuries in kids. They are dangerous for children. They are dangerous for a lot of reasons. The primary reason is that they're designed for an older person, an adult, and you put a young child on them who weighs a lot less, you have the weight horsepower ratio now suddenly changes, and as a result, these devices can go much faster with a 10-year-old child on it than they can with a 35-year-old guy. In addition, children don't have the strength or the skills to maneuver these devices safely. They oftentimes can't work the brakes adequately. They don't have the judgment calls that are necessary to operate these devices safely. And in general, I think they're incredibly dangerous devices. All-terrain vehicles, motorized dirt bikes, go-karts, they're all similar in that the children on these can go much, much faster than they're developmentally able to handle. And as a result, the chances of being in a crash are quite high. Now, because they're going very fast, the chances of having a significant injury are dramatically increased. Chances, you know, if you're going 35 miles an hour and you hit a fence or you hit a tree or a building or you roll over, your chances of having a serious injury is much greater than if you're on a bicycle going 5 miles an hour. It is simple physics. The amount of energy transferred is related to the speed squared. So the faster you're going, the much, much greater is the energy transferred, and that's really what hurts people. I would urge parents to not buy these devices for their child. Parents buy these devices and say, well, I'll make sure the child wears the helmet, wears the protective equipment. But you're not always going to be there, and the child is not always going to wear the helmet. And even if you are there, you're not going to prevent every crash from happening. I believe that people love their children, and I believe they want to see their children grow up to be safe, healthy individuals. And I think if parents need to really give much more careful thought to how they're going to make sure their children grow up, develop normally, have challenges, but do it in a safe fashion.
Well, let's take a short break. This is Public Health Radio. I'm your host, Marvin Malik. Our guest today is Fred Rivara, and we're discussing the problem of injuries as seen from the point of view of a public health practitioner. After the break, we'll be discussing some of the strategies used to prevent injuries and why injury analysis has generated so much more political controversy than the analysis of illness and diseases. Then, later in the show, I'll discuss the process that we at Public Health Radio have used to decide what topics to address on the show. So stay with us. This is Public Health Radio. I'm your host, Marvin Malik. My guest today is Fred Rivara, the director of the Division of General Pediatrics at the University of Washington in Seattle, and longtime director of the Harborview Injury Prevention and Research Center. We've been discussing the problem of injuries, how they can be studied and prevented using the same techniques as for diseases, epidemics, and other public health problems. Now back to the interview. Another source of injury, though a lot less common cause of death, would be injuries related to younger children at play, like in playgrounds. And I know there's been a great deal of attention paid to playground design. Has there been anything standardized, or at this point, are there national standards for that?
Well, there really are no required standards there. And I think that parents really should take a careful look at those. We have a child in a hospital right now who fell on one of those old-fashioned monkey bars and broke his arm. And those are the kinds of things that you and I grew up on that really, we know now, are quite dangerous. I think parents need to think about it in terms of how high up your child should be allowed to be. And if the child does fall, what is the child going to hit on the way down? Ideally, nothing, in that the surface is going to be an energy-absorbing surface, like wood chips, like sand, like pea gravel or ground-up tires. The playground's equipment, I think, varies tremendously across the country, from home playgrounds, which generally people don't put the kinds of protective surfaces underneath, to school playgrounds, which I think on the whole do a better job because of liability, to community playgrounds, which vary tremendously from being safe to being not so safe. And I think that parents need to sort of check those out very carefully, look at those, and just allow their child to play on equipment and in playgrounds which are safe. And generally, my experience is that playgrounds are going to be either safe or not. If there's some unsafe equipment there, generally all equipment's unsafe. And if people sort of understand safety, they're going to take out the unsafe equipment and replace it with safer equipment, make sure that the surface is well padded and that it's a safe place for children to play.
When we look at diseases, say, again, the example I gave earlier of SARS or HIV, there's usually very little politics involved in the sense that regardless of where you might fall on the political spectrum, everyone would want to analyze and do their best to prevent SARS or avian influenza or most any disease. But when it comes to injury, this has not always been the case. Some examples that really come to mind, some you've already given in terms of seatbelt laws, motorcycle helmet laws. And I was wondering if you could talk a bit about why that is and how that's maybe impacted your own career.
Well, it's a very good question, and it's an important question. I think that, first of all, people have approached injuries for far too long with a sense of fatalism, that injuries are going to happen and there's nothing you can do to prevent them. Well, we really know that that's not true. Secondly, people are referring back to their own childhood and said, well, you know, when I grew up, I sat in the back seat. I didn't have to wear a seatbelt, and, you know, I still don't, and I don't really see why we need to have people do it now. Or when I grew up, there was no such thing as bicycle helmets, and why do we have to have our kids wear them now? Well, the fact of the matter is, as you said earlier, is that injury fatalities are lower now than they were 10, 20, 30, 50 years ago. So, yes, the people who are alive now survived that. But you know what? A lot of people didn't. A lot of children, a lot of young adults did die as a result. We have to realize that there is a balance between infringement upon personal freedom and looking at what's good for the health of the community and the health of the public. Requiring somebody to wear a seatbelt is an infringement on their rights. I believe that. I understand that. However, we think that there is a social good to that. We realize that we are trying to protect people in many ways against their own poor behavior, but we also realize that the public on the whole has a financial interest in that. They're the ones that have to pay for special schooling for an individual who is injured in a car crash and can no longer go to regular school, or have to pay for disability payments or for Medicaid or Medicare for the rest of the person's life because they no longer can work because they have a severe disability. So the public does have, I think, an interest in trying to prevent these injuries that can be prevented. And then finally, there's some of those injuries not only affect yourself, but affect other people. We did a study published not long ago, which showed that if someone else is in a car is not wearing their seatbelt, and you're in a crash, your risk of dying, even if you're wearing a seatbelt, is increased by 25%, because those people act as a missile and can fly around the car and hurt you. So telling the person next to you, wear your seatbelt, I don't care if what happens to you, but I care what happens to me, is really appropriate. What people do not only affects them, it affects us. We certainly know that that's true of drunk driving. Not only are they a risk to themselves, but they're a risk to themselves, anyone else on the road. And I think the public has adopted a pretty intolerant attitude towards drunk driving, and appropriately intolerant. Now, there are certainly injury problems which do create political problems and political pressure, and certainly the most common of the one that comes to everybody's mind are guns. Firearm injuries are a big problem in this country. Over 30,000 people a year die from gun deaths. And I think what most people don't realize is that more than half of those deaths are actually suicides. When people think about guns, they always think about homicides. And in fact, that's true. They're a big cause of homicides. We know from a lot of work that having a gun in a home increases the risk of a violent death in the home, increases the risk that someone's going to use it to commit suicide, increases the risk that the firearm is going to be used and turned against you for homicide. And in fact, there's no data to suggest that it actually is going to decrease the risk of violent death in the home. That's going to, can be used successfully for self-defense all the time. There certainly are instances where I'm sure that that happens. But on the whole, in terms of the good of the community, there almost certainly are more deaths which are caused by guns than are prevented by guns. And we know that the public on the whole wants stricter regulations of guns, but there are powerful lobbying groups in the United States which do seem to have the ear of Congress, and as a result, we have a lot of laws in the books, but laws that have loopholes and laws that are uneven from one state to the next, and as a result, we continue to have major problem with gun injuries and deaths in this country.
Is it true that gun lobby, especially the National Rifle Association, that they've actually have not only tried to affect policy of state and federal governments in terms of guns, but they actually don't even want research done? Have they tried to cut off research funding?
That's correct. And it's been a problem really for the last 15 to 20 years in that the NRA doesn't believe this is a legitimate area for public health practitioners to be doing research in. They feel that it's inappropriate to do research. They don't believe the data. They try to lambast it. They try to undermine it. They try to deny its credibility in many ways. And ultimately, they have tried to decrease the funding for it. I think that
they've succeeded at that, right?
And they have succeeded to some degree at that. They have succeeded in some cuts in the past to the CDC budget. The CDC does fund some gun research. It's not the types of studies that they funded at one time, but they are doing a little bit of gun research now. But the NRA and those lobbying groups have vigorously opposed public health practitioners from doing gun research, and unfortunately at times in the past 20 years they've had the ear of Congress for that.
Another remarkable story within the field of injury relates to airbags, and I was reading a study out of the Harvard Injury Center indicated that the airbag was actually developed over 20 years before it actually started being used and researched. I was wondering if you are familiar with that issue.
Well, airbags is a complicated issue, and the effectiveness of airbags, I think, is still unclear. I mean, we've done some studies which seem to indicate that they're not terribly effective. The National Highway Traffic Safety Administration has done some studies which seem to show that they decrease the risk for unrestrained passengers by 10 to 15%. We do know that for young children, they increase the risk of death and serious injury, kids under the age of 13. They were initially developed in the 50s, and the technology for them to be mass-produced, I think, was available in the 60s. But the motor vehicle manufacturers vigorously oppose their use. And one of the reasons that we have as many seatbelt laws as we have in this country is that there is a trade-off. The Congress made a deal with the motor vehicle manufacturers if that two-thirds of the population was covered by seatbelt laws before a certain period of time, that we wouldn't have to require airbags. And so the car manufacturers got involved with pushing seatbelt laws. Fortunately, finally, the car manufacturers have begun to view vehicle safety as an important issue, and now airbags are required for both positions in the front seat. I think that they're an important element of prevention of injuries, but they're certainly not the most important element. And in fact, seatbelts are more effective than airbags. Unfortunately, not everybody wears their seatbelts, and that's why airbags are necessary.
The reduction in the rates of many types of injuries in the U.S. represents a significant triumph in the field of public health, and I'd like to know what some of the research has demonstrated on the effectiveness of the various injury prevention strategies, such as public education and environmental modification and others.
Well, I think that the first thing, as we talked a little bit earlier, is to sort of separate the motor vehicle crash from being injured, for example, or the bicycle crash from being injured, or the motorcycle crash from being injured. You can do various things to prevent the crash, but you can also do various things to prevent an injury even if the crash occurs. Thinking about those conceptually, so the airbag or the seatbelt doesn't prevent you from being in a crash, but certainly can prevent you from being injured if you're in a crash. But people have really thought hard about what might be the most effective strategies to prevent injuries. And for too long, it was poorly done educational programs aimed at the individual. Drive more safely. Use your seatbelt. Don't drink when you drive. Don't drink when you swim. Those kinds of advice that really was not terribly effective. Changes to the environment or changes to the product that we use can be very powerful in decreasing the risk of injuries. So changing car design, after Ralph Nader's 1966 book called Unsafe in Any Speed, that really resulted in changes in car design, which made them inherently safer. Having safer roads, the state highway system has contributed enormously to decreasing the rate of injuries per 100 million miles traveled. Those new expressways are much safer than the old country roads. Those kinds of environmental changes can make a big difference. But the same kind of conceptual model can also be applied to our everyday lives. We know that it's much better to go down the basement and lower your water heater temperature than to make sure that your child doesn't try to fill the bathtub by themselves and get a serious scald injury. We know that it's much better to have poison-proof caps on, child-proof caps on medications than to always make sure the poisons are out of reach of your child. We know that smoke detectors and sprinkler systems work and are probably in a much more effective way of preventing people from dying in fires than are harping on people not to smoke in bed. Those kinds of strategies, I think, have been adopted, and we need to continue to look for opportunities to adopt them to decrease the toll of injuries in the United States.
With children, is there a special obstacle in terms of education where the child may not even be developmentally able even to learn, like for children darting into the street?
Sure. There's, I think as a pediatrician, all the time we're trying to have parents be aware of what's developmentally appropriate for their child. And I think that your example about pedestrian injuries to children is a very good one. Children really aren't able to handle traffic safely by themselves until they're 10 years of age. Yet many parents, beginning when the child is, say, 6 and starting to go to school, begin to lessen their restrictions and allow the child to cross some streets by themselves. Sort of creates a vulnerable window for the child. The parents are giving this child more freedom, yet the child really is not developmentally able to handle it. And it's really in that 5 to 9 year age group where most pedestrian injuries happen. So looking at what's developmentally appropriate for a child and what isn't is key to protecting the child and keeping him safe.
You've spent a portion of your career in Malaysia and done several studies about injury in Africa. And I was wondering if you could give just a broad overview of how the issue of injury and injury control is different in the less developed countries compared to the U.S.
Well, I think that individuals are realizing that injuries, particularly among children and young adults, is a major problem in other parts of the world, the developing world. As infectious diseases or
combat it effectively, the problem of injuries really rises to the surface more. People are realizing that, injury prevention is critically important, particularly since sort of the healthcare systems are in many places still pretty underdeveloped, that the government might be better off spending some small amounts of money on prevention than large amounts of money on medical care.
Well, Fred Rivera, I'd like to thank you so much for joining us on Public Health Radio.
Thanks very much. Good to speak with you.
For listeners seeking more information on the topic of injury prevention, the website of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention has data and prevention fact sheets and many types of injuries and useful links to other websites. The website of the Center for Disease Control is cdc.gov. That's cdc.gov. Two national organizations are active in the area of childhood injury. These are the National Safe Kids Campaign, whose web address is safekids.org, and the website of the American Academy of Pediatrics has a wealth of useful information on childhood injury prevention, including a particularly effective presentation on keeping children safe during travel in motor vehicles, highlighting the different types of car seats that are appropriate for children of different ages. Their website is aap.org. That's aap.org. Coming up next, I'll answer a question listeners often ask. How do we decide what topics to cover on Public Health Radio? So stay with us. Listeners to Public Health Radio often ask how we learn about the news items and ideas for guests who appear on the show. The extra few minutes available today will allow me to answer that question. When I was a child, my family tuned in every evening to Walter Cronkite for the CBS Evening News. Cronkite concluded each broadcast with a standard line, "And that's the way it is, February 17th, 1961. Years later, Cronkite expressed regret about using that line. After hosting Public Health Radio for 4 years, it's very easy to see why Cronkite ought to regret his closing line. The issue of what to cover on this news show is something we grapple with every month. Whether it comes to news items, extended interviews, or commentaries, the decision on what to cover always feels rather arbitrary. On a near daily basis, I review suggestions from listeners, news sources ranging from medical and public health journals, reports from the World Health Organization and the Center for Disease Control, as well as regular news media outlets. As one might guess, this leads to thousands of items to choose from. So what do we choose to air? Though I don't know the geography of those who tune in to Public Health Radio over the web, on the radio, the show currently airs only in the U.S., and we therefore emphasize public health issues that are important to Americans. But that doesn't narrow the list very much. So we've explored issues ranging from the epidemic of diabetes to the reasons for the steady increase in breast cancer incidence in the U.S., and we've looked at the impact of urban sprawl on public health, as well as the environmental health policies of the Bush administration. Based on discussions with listeners, most of Public Health Radio's listeners are tuning into enough mainstream media to hear the latest updates on the one or two health issues that the media have decided to focus on. Over time, I have become increasingly less likely to cover issues the mainstream media are covering adequately. But there are exceptions. And we'll cover these topics when we have alternative perspectives the media aren't presenting. And this is not terribly uncommon. Think of the issue of abortion. We've all heard the arguments of both supporters and opponents of abortion rights. But is that all there is to the issue? Does the discussion have to begin and end with an unbreachable gap of disagreement? I don't think so. A moment's thought would lead anyone who looks at the abortion issue to the realization that both supporters and opponents want the number of abortions to decrease. So it would seem to make sense to explore what policies actually accomplish this. On an upcoming show, we'll take a transnational look at abortion and look at the actual statistics. Which countries have the lowest abortion rates? And when we look at countries with low abortion rates, what are the social and legal environments that have led to low rates of abortion? State after state across the U.S. have created legal barriers to abortion. Is that strategy actually effective in reducing the number of abortions? On this and many other issues, spending more time than the 2-minute maximum allowed on TV can lead to helpful insights. The topic that has been most popular among listeners to the show have been airings that deal with the issue of the millions of Americans who have no form of health insurance. It's not hard to find that issue compelling. After all, we are the wealthiest nation in human history. Last year, we aired a show on screening for cervical cancer, and the year before, on screening for breast cancer. But one can hardly blame a woman who has no health insurance to not bother getting screened if she couldn't possibly afford treatment were a malignancy actually to be discovered. On February 9th last year, the Senate Majority Leader, Bill Frist, announced that achieving universal health care in the U.S. is impossible. He emphasized the word impossible, using it more than once. Universal health care would be too expensive. Leaving aside the issue of what priorities have been funded and whether they actually help our citizens as much as universal health care would, not one of the reporters asked Senator Frist to comment on why universal health care is not only possible, but is a fact of life in all the other developed countries. And every one of those nations spends far less than we do to cover every citizen from cradle to grave. It will be a continuing project of Public Health Radio to explore that issue, especially trying to learn what we can from the experiences of other nations, since there is no successful model in the United States. Though the emphasis of Public Health Radio has been on issues of importance within the U.S., global health issues have also been the focus on many occasions. The world has grown far too small to ignore the remainder of the globe, especially when months and even years passed without the mainstream news media even mentioning most of the countries in the world. In fact, the only guarantee the mainstream media will mention any of the countries of the global south is when the politicians in Washington are alleging terrorist activities, weapons of mass destruction, or intending to mount an invasion. Remember Grenada, Panama, and Nicaragua? Only 20 years after invading and occupying two and financing a mercenary war in the third, we scarcely hear about any of them. Hard to believe that for months on end before we invaded, it seemed as though we heard more about the threat those countries posed than we did about the rest of the world combined. And decades can pass without entire stretches of the globe meriting even a mention. On last month's show, we explored health issues in Brazil and Indonesia. Even though these are two of the most influential countries in the world, we rarely hear a word about either one. Even a natural disaster on the caliber of this December 26th tsunami did not seem to provoke more than a superficial, disaster-related coverage of Indonesia, the largest Islamic nation and the fourth most heavily populated country in the world. And of course, with the HIV epidemic, our generation is experiencing the greatest public health crisis the world has faced since the Black Death 8 centuries ago. When it comes to the HIV epidemic's impact on the poor nations of the global south, the mainstream media's lack of coverage, near silence, truly is deafening. So at Public Health Radio, we'll be traveling frequently to countries the mainstream media won't take you to. Finally, Public Health Radio is not designed to be a medical show. Such shows are widely available through other media outlets. This show covers advances in medicine or surgery only when they are of major significance to the public health. But ultimately, despite these general guidelines, the decision about what to air on public health radio feels somewhat arbitrary when there is so much to choose from. Based on the very positive listener feedback we receive, we will likely maintain our areas of emphasis roughly as they have been. But even if public health radio aired every day, the issue of what issues to cover and which to ignore will never be easy. Faced with the thousands of choices of news items we encounter each month, I often feel like I'm acting as a censor for everything we don't present. Walter Cronkite's tenure has given way to a new generation of journalists who don't specifically say, "That's the way it is," at the end of their shows. But after tuning into the evening news nowadays, one still gets the feeling that now you know what's gone on in the world today. If this editorial gets across one point, it would be that those network evening news broadcasts and this show and any attempt at presentation of news is conveying only one or two viewpoints on a tiny fraction of the issues that affect our lives and our health every day. On public health radio, you get to hear some of the news. That's all you'll hear us claim each month when we introduce the show. We're quite interested in listener feedback and are open to suggestions and alternative visions about what issues public health radio ought to address. For comments and feedback, call your station. Or, to listen to previous shows or to provide comments via email, check out our website, publichealthradio.org. That's publichealthradio.org. Also, public health radio needs volunteers, especially in the areas of promotion and grant writing. Let us know if you'd like to help with public health radio. Well, that's it for today's show. Thanks for listening, and join us again next month for another airing of Public Health Radio.